Chapter 2. In all that is done in the universe, the divine through his Shakti is behind all action, but he is veiled by his Yoga Maya and works through the ego of the Jiva in the lower nature. In yoga also, it is the divine who is the sadhaka and the sadhana. It is his Shakti with her light, power, knowledge, consciousness, ananda, acting upon the adhara, and, when it is open to her, pouring into it with these divine forces that makes the sadhana possible. But so long as the lower nature is active, the personal effort of the sadhaka remains necessary. The personal effort required is a triple labor of aspiration, rejection, and surrender. An aspiration vigilant, constant, unceasing. The mind's will, the heart's seeking, the ascent of the vital being, the will to open and make plastic the physical consciousness and nature. Rejection of the movements of the lower nature. Rejection of the mind's ideas, opinions, preferences, habits, constructions, so that the true knowledge may find free room in a silent mind. Rejection of the vital nature's desires, demands, cravings, sensations, passions, selfishness, pride, arrogance, lust, greed, jealousy, envy, hostility to the truth, so that the true power and joy may pour from above into a calm, large, strong, and consecrated vital being. Rejection of the physical nature's stupidity, doubt, disbelief, obscurity, obstinacy, pettiness, laziness, unwillingness to change, tamas, so that the true stability of light, power, ananda may establish itself in a body growing always more divine. Surrender of oneself and all one is and has, and every plane of the consciousness and every movement to the divine and the Shakti. In proportion as this surrender and self-consecration progress, the sadhaka becomes conscious of the divine Shakti doing the sadhana, pouring into him more and more of herself, founding in him the freedom and perfection of the divine nature. The more this conscious process replaces his own effort, the more rapid and true becomes his progress. But it cannot completely replace the necessity of personal effort until the surrender and consecration are pure and complete from top to bottom. Note that a tamasic surrender, refusing to fulfill the conditions and calling on God to do everything and save one all the trouble and struggle, is a deception and does not lead to freedom and perfection. So, we've been reading these first couple of sections of the mother, marking that this book, which saw its first publication in 1928, is really a handful of letters with an opening message that were written in 1927. The ashram had been begun on the 24th of November, 1926, officially. It took Sri Aurobindo a couple of days to mull it over and agree to call it an ashram. He was reluctant to do that because his aim was never to renounce the world or to shut this community off from life around, which is the usual connotation which the term ashram carries, that of a monastery, that of a hermitage. He never renounced the world. Indeed, he more and more fully embraced the world. And because of that capital realization on the 24th of November, 1926, he felt emboldened to move into a new phase of sadhana and to bring forward the person who was not simply his radiant collaborator, but who was essential to the success of this entire endeavor. They knew her first as Mira. They came to know her as the mother. Indeed, this compendium of letters that we call the book The Mother is about her, but it's also about the largest lines of insight and philosophy available to the aspiring human soul. So I hope that you will permit me to go through this second letter one element at a time, and let's talk about it. First, this is a letter that is born in correspondence to a gentleman who lived in Gujarat whose name was Motilal Mehta. Sri Aurobindo wrote a letter to him on the 30th of May, 1927. I think you'd be interested in this. Motilal asked, "What I want to know is, when does God take full charge of our sadhana? The sadhana described in the Arya in the beginning was based on the conviction that God was the sadhak. In subsequent years, individual effort was permitted in Arya, something like cooperation between the individual and God." So you see this interplay. Sri Aurobindo writes, "This is an error. There is no such variation in the beginning of the Arya and in subsequent years." So Motilal then writes, "In the message of February," which to us is the first chapter of the book, The Mother, "in the message of February, the operator is God, and the individual becomes the operated. The individual effort consists in fasting, etc., before and during the operation." To which Sri Aurobindo responds, "What is all this about operations and fasting? Certainly, I cannot have written anything of the kind. But we saw, actually, that in fact Sri Aurobindo had in his record of yoga written about the necessity of an opening from below and a descent from above affecting a dramatic change in consciousness, and he was writing, in fact, in the context of seeing if he could work out within the body itself some method by which, by pushing away food, by renouncing food, this divinization could occur. So, in those days, it might have been possible that people could have access to his papers. There were a number of people present in the ashram who were familiar with his work that is now recorded in the record of yoga, Sapta Chatushtaya, the seven quartets, and the various elements that came into play on that. But when this letter is written, Sri Aurobindo at least did not remember having given access to people to read. Perhaps they were taking advantage of his liberality. But something like that was correct in Motilal's question. Now, he goes on to write another portion, posing this: what are the signs of the coming of the divine grace? Does the divine grace take full charge of the sadhana as soon as the sadhak gives the charge? If not, when will it take full charge? And then Sri Aurobindo answers, if he gives full charge truly and really, with an absolute sincerity of total surrender, and does not come in the way of the divine grace. How many can do that? It cannot be done by a word or by taking up a mental posture. Calling on God to do everything and save one all the trouble and struggle is a self-deception and does not lead to freedom and perfection. So we see that that line becomes pivotal in what we call Chapter 2. And indeed, Sri Aurobindo, in his copy of this letter, turned the page over and wrote out Chapter 2 on it. Now, it's interesting that Motilal was living in Gujarat, so Sri Aurobindo had a number of disciples who were very close to him, who were seriously practicing sadhana, and yet were not there in the ashram. So this idea that you can't do yoga unless you are there in Pondicherry was from the beginning an absurdity. You cheat yourself of all your possibilities if you think that you have to be in a particular place. It's where is your consciousness? So we know that the letter was written in 1927, and we know the context is one of collective yoga. This is not simply about Mother and Sri Aurobindo practicing a sadhana to advance the evolution of consciousness on earth, but that it's a group of people, 24 to 30 people by now, working on a program constantly, day and night, waking and sleeping, working and meditating. But the emphasis is on something that is active. In fact, look at the first line of this, in all that is done in the universe. In other words, the universe has relevance. In all that is done in the universe, the divine, through his Shakti, is behind all action, but he is veiled by his yoga maya and works through the ego of the jiva in the lower nature. This is an idea that, of course, we're familiar with in the Tantra, but it also appears in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. In the fourth section, look at verses 8 and 9 if you have an opportunity. There, the Lord, Isha, produces the universe through the power of Maya. But here, Maya does not have the connotation that it will take in Advaita Vedanta. But instead has the connotation of that which measures out, which takes the infinite and compresses it into a finite form. And he does it says the Upanishad, through his Shakti, through his power. So already, several centuries before the Common Era, we see this idea of a divine consciousness using Shakti to produce a world that installs its own presence within it. The term Shakti, from the root shak, to be strong, represents power, energy, but not unconscious power, but a power which is full of self-awareness, which becomes dynamic as an act of self-awareness. So the divine is everywhere in the universe, and any action undertaken within the universe is affected by this Shakti, but veiled by his yoga maya. Yoga maya. Maya again. This idea that it is a capacity of the infinite consciousness to take and represent something of itself in a limited form, but in which somehow, nevertheless, infinity dwells. So though it has been reduced, it is still full. Purna. This is full. That is full. The very chant that we opened our evening with. Veiled by his yoga maya. So it's a maya which is in union with the divine. The yoga maya, in a sense, takes the power of this union and invests the entire universe in an involutionary state with the complete presence and consciousness of the divine. One can't see it because it is veiled. Sri Aurobindo is not going to use the philosophic language of the life divine here and say that it is how the superconscient becomes the inconscient, which is the whole riddle of the mystery of the world, but essentially that's it. So, the power of the divine consciousness is present in all things and works now consciously, because we're back in the human scene, works through the ego of the jiva. What is the jiva? The jiva, from jiv, to live, means what is alive, a being that is alive. It is an aspect of the divine. Go to the Bhagavad Gita. It is a portion of the Supreme Person, of the Purushottama. Chapter 7, verses 5 through 7, when you have a chance. The jiva is an expression of the Supreme Nature, not simply of the consciousness, but of para prakriti, as the Supreme Nature. The individual comes from that. Here, in the world, veiled by the ego. So, when the ego is active, the true individual, the essence of what is valid in each person, is not on the surface to see, but is present and works in co-agency with the divine presence and with the will of the divine above to manifest the divine will. So the divine is present universally. It is an omnipresent reality, which is how the life divine opens. Turn the page. It says omnipresent reality. Turn another page and it says the human aspiration. The human aspiration is an expression of the constant, unlosable reality of the Divine Presence. In yoga also, it is the divine who is the sataka and the satana. So let's talk about the root here. Sad in Sanskrit means to go straight. So a sataka is one who goes straight and fulfills or completes. The sadhana is that path that leads straight to the goal, that method that enforces reaching the goal. So both sides of it, the sadhana, the path, and the sadhaka, the seeker, are really the divine. So if you're on the path, it is because the divine in you has chosen to go there. Then he says, it is his Shakti, with her light, power, knowledge, consciousness, ananda. In other words, go back to the life divine, chit shakti, sat chit ananda. This is the aspect of chit as it comes forward, chit shakti, chit tapas, with all of the knowledge, the seas and oceans of delight, the consciousness that cannot be aborted, which becomes active and infuses itself into the adhara. And adhara is a Sanskrit term for the support. Imagine it as being a jar or a pot or even a pond in which great energy, great gatherings occur. A pot is an apt instrument because the water that you would put into a pot is the symbol of consciousness in Sanskrit. So, when the adhara is open, then the divine forces can descend, in a sense, fill the pot. We have to empty the pot. We have to prepare our vehicle, our adhara, our own jars, to be filled with a divine elixir. What is luminous? What is full of bliss? And if we are fully opened, as Sri Aurobindo suggested in his letter to Motilal, then it is possible for that to be done all at once. But until it has been done, we make the effort. And so, the personal effort consists of aspiration, rejection, and surrender, which then figure in the rest of Sri Aurobindo's correspondence in letters of yoga for a couple of dozen years. And we look at this an aspiration in the mind, in the heart, in the vital being, in the will, trying to make plastic even the physical consciousness. So it is not simply an internal psychological change, not simply the illumination of the quarters of the being which are in contact with the soul that is important, but an aspiration that opens all the nature. A rejection of the movements of the lower nature. And I remember the first time that I ever had a study with a group on the book, The Mother, one of our dear souls cried out and said, but look at this. this is all I am. Everything that is listed here is what exactly I am. Well, that's right, because it represents the obscurity of nature as it turns towards reunion with the divine, and so has to proceed from ignorance to knowledge, from disintegration to full unity, from insentience back to Ananda, and that whole climb means to discover and reject all of these things, which are not really our possessions, but which are signatures of that original movement of consciousness away from its origin. So it's good that we become aware of it, and good, even better, that we offer it and are willing to dispossess ourselves of it, no? So the surrender. He writes simply of aspiration and surrender. It's the rejection that is, he has to list a catalog, but surrender all that you are throughout your being as you discover it. Every movement. So it's place and dynamism both. It's both the form and the movement of that form that are offered. A surrender is samarpana. It's the giving of oneself. You go into the world, you find a flower, and you bring it back, and you offer it. And it's wonderful. It's a discovery of something delightful. But you go into yourself, and you find something. You say, ah, look what I discovered here. And that insight leads to an offering. And the offering leads to a response, as we saw in the first chapter. That is what prasad is. That is what grace is. You offer, the divine receives and gives to you. But the divine, as it says here, is already within you, is the sadhak and the sadhana. So the very aspiration that you're giving yourself truly to, the rejection of all that is repellent, and the surrender of everything that you can discover, is the seal between your soul and that spiritual consciousness above to complete this journey, to bring you back to there without getting rid of the here. The here and the there united. Then he says, in proportion as the surrender and self-consecration progress, the sadhaka becomes conscious of the divine shakti doing the sadhana. Now this will become really clear in subsequent chapters where Sri Aurobindo describes the nature of conscious work. But really, the ego loses the sense of authorship and sees that all is being conducted by this tremendous conscious presence and power within. That all is really affected through that. And so you work in collaboration with, in completion with, that conscious process, which replaces but does not erase your personal effort. A personal effort from a part seeking that contact begins the process. It leads to communion, and that leads to union. He says, consecration must be there purely from top to bottom. To consecrate means to make sacred. what it means for us is not the sanctimonious reading of the verb, but the word means to us that it's made whole. It has been put in touch with the true reality that is there, which is Sat-Chit-Ananda. So a consecration is right and auspicious when you become truly aware of what you are, and in that take delight. And then this last sentence, note that a tamasic surrender, refusing to fulfill the conditions and calling on God to do everything and save one all the trouble and struggle, is a deception and does not lead to freedom and perfection. I don't think it really needs comment. So, it took us 3 weeks to do the first chapter. We've finished the second chapter in 40 minutes. Are we on pace now? I think I'd like to read a page or so from Savitri to you. This is from Book One, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. And I'll read through a break in the poetry. All she can do is marvelous in his sight. He revels in her, a swimmer in her sea, a tireless amateur of her world delight. He rejoices in her every thought and act, and gives consent to all that she can wish. Whatever she desires, he wills to be. The Spirit, the innumerable one, he has left behind his lone eternity. He is an endless birth in endless time, her finite's multitude in an infinite space. The master of existence lurks in us and plays at hide and seek with his own force. In nature's instrument loiters secret God. The immanent lives in man as in his house. He has made the universe his pastime's field, a vast gymnasium of his works of might. All-knowing, he accepts our darkened state. Divine wears shapes of animal or man. Eternal, he assents to fate and time. Immortal, dallies with mortality. The all-conscious ventured into ignorance. The all-blissful bore to be insensible. Incarnate in a world of strife and pain, he puts on joy and sorrow like a robe, and drinks experience like a strengthening wine. He whose transcendence rules the pregnant vasts, prescient now dwells in our subliminal depths, a luminous individual power alone. The absolute, the perfect, the alone, has called out of the silence his mute force, where she lay in the featureless and formless hush, guarding from time by her immobile sleep, the ineffable puissance of his solitude. The absolute, the perfect, the alone, has entered with his silence into space. He has fashioned these countless persons of one self. He has built a million figures of his power. He lives in all who lived in his vast alone. Space is himself, and time is only he. The absolute, the perfect, the immune, one who is in us as our secret self, our mask of imperfection has assumed. He has made this tenement of flesh his own, his image in the human measure cast, that to his divine measure we might rise. Then, in a figure of divinity, the Maker shall recast us and impose a plan of Godhead on the mortal's mold, lifting our finite minds to his infinite, touching the moment with eternity. This transfiguration is earth's due to heaven. A mutual debt binds man to the supreme. His nature we must put on as he put ours. We are sons of God and must be even as he. His human portion, we must grow divine. Our life is a paradox with God for key. Namaste. Jai Ma.